This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Happy New Year. That's the Soviets.
New Year, yes.
What do you mean it's the Soviets?
The Soviets got rid of Christmas and celebrated only New Year's.
Wow.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Kim Jong-un of the Education Reform Movement, Chris Tassoni.
How's it going, Mike?
Good, good. How do you like that comparison there, huh?
Yeah, even though I studied Russian, I'm actually not a communist.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, we don't know about this guy. This is the son. First of all, you and he are about the same age.
That's true.
Now, do you feel like you are ready to be the head of a state?
I think I could. I'm a finance guy. You know, I got the money going on.
All right. See, it's that kind of strength and confidence that you need in a totalitarian dictator. So I think maybe it's not so. No. Look, the comparison here is that you are up and coming, Chris. You know,
I suppose so.
You are, and you're going to soon, you know, you're arising to be part of the Education Gadfly Show dynasty.
I'm working on it.
All right. Chris has been on the show before in a short-lived segment that we had called, what was it? What was that segment called?
Dollars and Cents, Mike.
Dollars and Cents. Well, we had like one or two of those, and then they just went away.
I had a few, but money always depresses people, so it wasn't quite as fun as Chris Irvine's What's Up With That.
That's true. The ratings were suffering, so sorry about that. But you're now back as a co-host for our special holiday edition of the Education Gadfly Show. You know, I want to tell you, listeners, if you are listening to this the Thursday before Christmas, you are a diehard Education Gadfly Show fan in Edugwonk, and we commend you for that. Some people would say, hey, Fordham folks, you don't need to do a podcast this week. You don't need to put out a gadfly this week, right? I mean, who's going to be around to listen to it? Who's going to be around to read it? I mean, is this what's really on people's mind right now as they're getting ready to frantically buying gifts, getting ready for the holiday season? We say, balderdash. Yes, this is what the people want, and we provide it.
Well, I'm proud to be starting today, Mike.
All right, good. Okay, we got a lot to cover because, you know, the education reform world moves on. It does not take a vacation. Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Great. Question number one. As 2011 draws to a close, I kind of have to ask the requisite. What was the most far-reaching education reform of the past 12 months?
Ooh, this is the best of worst of list. I like this. I guess we're just doing best of. What's your best of, Chris?
I got to say it's the Wisconsin budget repair bill, Mike. It's the collective bargaining reform that Scott Walker did. I think it's going to change the face of education in Wisconsin, make it much more sustainable for the state.
Now I see that, but isn't this basically just, well, Wisconsin finally did what like 25 other states have already done, which is not allow collective bargaining around these issues?
Well, I think that they've pushed the culture in the state to be more focused on sustainability. And I think, you know, relative to states that have had this situation for a long time, I mean, I think Wisconsin school districts are going to be empowered more to push for better provisions in the agreements that they strike with teachers.
All right. No, I don't mean to give you a hard time. I think that was a hugely important reform. And of course, it's still in place, unlike Ohio's collective bargaining reform, which has been wiped away by the voters. I'm going to go with Indiana's education reforms and our good friend Tony Bennett, our ed reform idol, as we crowned him this August. Really, I mean, this is, you know, several people have said this is the biggest sweep of reforms in a single state since Florida in 1998 under Jeb Bush. I think that's true. And I think Indiana is now positioned to be the leader on education reform for many years to come, and just across so many different issues, you know, school choice, teacher quality, collective bargaining, pensions. I mean, it's they went after all of it, and it was comprehensive and ambitious. And we salute the Hoosier State.
Tony's a rock star, and people are always so impressed when I say that I've met him. I don't mention he's not a singer.
Ah, ba-bum. Okay, oh boy, Chris, not bad. It's not quite the same humor that Rick Hess would use, but it's good.
It's got
we
some
like
singers.
A good pun every now and then. Okay, Daniela, question number two.
The Miami Herald this week released data showing that charter schools in Florida serve fewer special ed students than their district counterparts. Is this a key fault with the charter school movement?
Well, look, Chris, I mean, first of all, the data don't look like this everywhere in the country. I mean, there's plenty of places where the special ed rates look close to what the public schools are doing, though they are often lower. Now, one question is whether that's because they are not labeling kids with mild learning disabilities as special ed, because that's not a part of their philosophy. And that's part of a lot of charter schools say, look, part of our philosophy is we don't label kids. The other issue is if they're a small school, they're not going to be able to serve everybody and every single type of disability. No, you know, other public schools don't serve every type of disability. A district, you know, has the ability to say we're going to serve certain kids over here and certain kids over there.
Yeah, I think part of the argument is diverse schools for diverse kids, Mike. I mean, D.C. actually has one or two specialty special ed schools that are charters that serve exclusively those populations. So certainly we need safeguards to make sure that the charter movement writ large is serving these kids. But I think different schools have different strengths.
Yeah. Now, it is important that these schools are not discriminating against kids with special ed. And you understand public schools saying, look, what's happening is that you're taking all the easy kids, you know, the motivated kids with motivated families who don't have these special challenges. And what's left is that we have all the kids who are either poor, have families that aren't informed about choice or aren't motivated to find out. And we've got the special ed kids and they're expensive and they're hard to educate. And so as a result, you know, you're making our life a lot harder. I mean, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, I think we particularly have to be careful in this charter movement when we hold up successes, for example, like, you know, the Kips of the world, that we hold them up as successes but don't use them to beat public schools over the head. I mean, this line that says, well, if Kip can do it, so can you. I think that's where we start to get into danger because public schools say, well, what if the kids are different? What if Kip's not serving the same number of special ed kids? What if this? What if that? I mean, that's a separate issue about the DART. I think we should focus on, hey, these charter schools deserve support and our encouragement and replication because they're doing amazing things, but let's not use them to hit the other schools over the head. Okay, topic number three.
Data out of Seattle this week reveals that Black students who speak English in the home score worse on state tests than Black students who speak another language in the home, implying that immigrant students fare better than their native born counterparts. What do we make of these data?
Chris? Wow. I mean, this is explosive stuff. How do you look at this?
Well, I mean, it shows what a challenge we have in this country for African-American students for a variety of reasons, that they are lagging behind folks who, you know, look the same as them to a lot of Americans. But the cultural factors at home are different. Even their teachers probably perceive them differently because of knowing their backgrounds. So it's tough. It's unfortunate that in Seattle, you know, certain kids are getting opportunities and have backgrounds that push them ahead in ways that other kids are not.
You know, the reporter called me for this one, and I have a little quote in the article on this, and I say, look, but, you know, first of all, we've known this. There's been studies that have shown, for example, on elite college campuses, a lot of the African Americans that are there are actually of African immigrant descent very recently, you know, first or second generation, or from Caribbean descent, which is interesting as well. I mean, this is sort of, you know, that Barack Obama was kind of typical in this respect, and that when you actually look at the number of African American kids who come from, you know, basically slave backgrounds, that the numbers are shockingly low. Now, what I also said was, look, you've got immigrants that are coming over from relatively well-educated countries, or at least they're the middle class, upper middle class, the ones that are coming over. They've got that social capital. Though the article points out that even Somali refugees in Seattle were outscoring the African-American kids. And that's where you start to say, wow, this is really hard stuff and hard to understand. You know, is it some kind of institutional racism it's still a factor that plays out differently? Or is it just something about the social capital of what's going on in the families?
Yeah, and I think the answer is probably both. You know, we have certainly examples of teachers in school districts all across the country being caught doing and saying things against their African-American students, which are shocking. But we also know that, you know, growing up in single-parent households, which many Black students do, doesn't set you up for great success in education. Certainly, poverty is a factor. So I think the answer is both.
You know, in other cities that have had a large African immigration movement, such as Washington, D.C., metro area around here, I hope that other school districts look at this question as well. I mean, it may be, you know, we've seen strong progress for African-American kids on the NAEP and some other tests, at least over time, still way, way behind. But again, it's making gains. It would be very disappointing if we find out that part of what's driving that is the inclusion of African immigrant kids, that the other African-American kids are still treading water. We need to know that, though, if that's what's happening. And so it was good for Seattle to dig into these data.
Yeah, shows the power of disaggregated data. It's awesome.
The power of disaggregated data. You love it. He's got a big grin on his face. I wish we could take a picture of that. That's all the time we got this week for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
May I wish you a Merry Christmas?
Thank you. Merry Christmas. I'm so happy we can do that around
Merry
here, right?
Christmas,
we don't
Amber.
Have to do Happy Holidays. Yay.
That's right. But we can wish you other holidays, too. Happy Hanukkah. Uh-huh. Happy Kwanzaa.
Yes, we can.
Happy, what else?
Happy New Year. That's the Soviets.
New Year, yes.
What do you mean it's the Soviets?
The Soviets got rid of Christmas and celebrated only New Year's.
Oh, wow.
There are all these great New Year's comedies from the Soviet era. They're actually funny, believe it or not.
Chris's obscure knowledge that we have here. I think he watched some of those comedies in Russian.
I did.
Yeah, that's impressive.
It's always a little fishy that Chris decided to take up Russian as his major.
Yeah, I know. A little spy action going on.
Maybe.
Never
know.
I really missed the window on that.
Yeah, he did, actually. That was poor timing.
Dang, I feel old.
All right. But speaking about good timing, we have a very timely study out of Boston.
Boston, yes, you do. Marty West, John Fullerton, bunch of smart guys.
We love those guys.
NBER paper, their colleagues and Marty examine the impact of the Boston teacher residency program. This has been gotten all kinds of kudos in the past years. It's a year-long mentorship for new teachers operated by Boston Public Schools and a nonprofit. They examined teacher and student data from 01, 02 to 2010, 2011. They compared BTR teachers and other novice teachers. Incidentally, BTR teachers comprise about 5% of all Boston Public School teachers. They found that the BTR graduates are more racially diverse than other novices, more likely to teach math and science, more likely to remain in teaching for at least 5 years. They also compared value-added math and ELA test scores for a small subset of BTR teachers, about 50 of them. They found them no more effective than other novices in enhancing ELA achievement, less effective in math by about 9% of a standard deviation, which equates to roughly 2 months of instruction for an upper elementary school student. However, the performance gap between the two groups narrows in year two and three, and by year four and five, the BTR teachers outperform teachers with the same level of experience but nearly the same degree. The analysts in the end acknowledge the importance of BTR students catching up to their teaching peers in math, but question whether the impact of the program merits the cost, which is unfortunately not examined. Ooh, did I get that in?
You did, but I am totally confused. So wait a minute. All right, now let's be clear about these programs.
Okay.
I mean, so my understanding is somebody goes in, they get paid a salary, but they're not the teacher of record.
That's right.
But they're in a residency, so they're sort of like student teaching for the whole year.
For the whole year.
Mm-hmm. Right? And then they're what, taking grad school classes at night or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're gradually taking on more responsibility of that class.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how it's shocking that these aren't better prepared than teachers who just have one semester of student teaching?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are all these hypotheses, and one of which is the teachers don't give up the reins. And so these teachers actually never get the full responsibility of the classroom, that they continue to be sort of sheltered and protected. I mean, that's one theory that the authors threw out there. I mean, we could come up with many more. But, how much responsibility are they getting in this year internship?
And then it might be less responsibility than a normal student teacher would?
Perhaps.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just surprising. But they stay in longer.
They stay in longer, right. That obviously made the program operators pretty happy about that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this has been, I feel like, spun as positive results, although, again, it just seems like kind of wishy-washy. These things are really expensive,
yeah.
Right?
I have no idea. I looked on the website page. I looked in the appendix of the study. I don't know how much this program is.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea?
Well, my sense is if you're paying people a salary, 30 or 40 K, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're getting 30 or 40 K. I could be wrong about that. I know that I read that they have to reimburse up to $10,000 if they don't finish.
Okay.
So you'd think it might be more, but I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Be good to know how much they get.
Yeah. Well, from a cost effectiveness point of view, Chris, Mr. Finance Expert, I mean, how do you look at this situation?
Well, so Boston actually is home to another example that's trying to get at this kind of preparation program, which is the Match School. They take a different tack, which is that instead of having these folks shadow as teachers, they're tutors in a residential environment. So there might be, to Amber's point about the teachers not giving up control of the classroom, maybe they just haven't found the right way at preparing these folks in the classroom that will both add value that's worth their salary and get them to be better teachers. So
I think the right answer is it's too expensive. Sounds like a lot of money. And it's interesting that the NEA just last week touted teacher residencies as a big part of their plan going forward. And we have this study coming out that I think, raises some significant questions.
I'm with you.
All right. Not to be the Grinch.
Not going to object to that.
All right. Okay, Amber. So what song goes along
with this? All right.
This?
So this is by the Standells. It's about Boston. I hope I get this right. And it's called Dirty Water.
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you about my town. Love.
Are you a Red Sox fan by any chance?
I actually grew up a Chicago Cubs fan in Southern Illinois, Cardinals country. It's tough.
Yeah,
I know you're a Cardinals fan.
I am a Cardinals fan. Again, I mean, this is two strikes against him here. I mean, if you're not a Red Sox fan, which Joe likes, you're not a Cardinals fan, which I like. What good are you?
It's tradition, Mike.
Now it's time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That? Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes, Chris, I like the red and green you're sporting today.
Yes, well, I'm trying to keep in the Christmas theme here, and I've done so again with my segment today.
Let's hear it.
Well, it seems that the war in Iraq wasn't enough to quench the thirst for blood in one Massachusetts town, so they've decided to declare war on Christmas. Since 1960, firefighters in the town of Saugus have dressed up like Santa Claus and visited every elementary school, handing out coloring books. But on Monday, the school superintendent, district superintendent told firefighters that they would not be welcomed into the classrooms. Certainly everyone acknowledges their holiday in a special way they want, this district superintendent said, but there is a conflict between the church and the state in that regard. Banning Santa for religious reasons? What's up with that? We've had 3 weeks now of these Scrooge-like stories from schools, but this one just might be the most ridiculous. Explain to me how Santa is connected in any way whatsoever to the religious parts of Christmas. Is there some sort of reverse Da Vinci Code conspiracy out there claiming Santa is part of Jesus' genealogy? I mean, is it Eliakim, Levi, Elmadam, Kosum, Matthias, Nagai, Mahat, or Zerubbabel that's leaving those presents under my tree? But even when presented with the fact that Santa has no religious affiliation, the superintendent would not budge. Fortunately, a school board member was willing to call a spade, declaring the Santa controversy a case of political correctness gone amok. At least one person in Saugus knows that the subjects of O Holy Night and Twas the Night Before Christmas are in fact not related.
Oh, God, Chris, that was my all-time favorite.
I had to end the year on a bang, Mike.
I mean, the thing is, right, I mean, people who are devoutly Christian oftentimes complain about the commercialization of Christmas right. And that all this focus on Santa Claus instead of on Jesus Christ. So this has it all backwards.
I don't know. It's just like a total lose for everybody involved here.
So what's the outcome? I mean, are they doing the run to the schools or not?
So I followed up on it, and apparently the community just totally rallied behind these firefighters and were so upset that the district has temporarily allowed the firefighters to continue coming in as Santa Claus this year, but then there's going to be a community meeting about it in January.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing the results of that.
Yeah, they are to come.
Well, what a great way to go. Well, everybody have a happy holidays, a great end to 2011. We will see you in 2012. Until then,
I'm Chris Tassoni.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, The Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.